The Public Safety Committee will come to order. I'm not sure, we don't quite have a... We do have, okay. So, members, today we have a one bill, and then we have the overview of the Human Rights Department budget. We also need a motion to approve the minutes of February 20th and February 21st.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move those minutes.
Thank you. Representative Lohmer moves the minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. A reminder, members, that if you're going to go to on the tour to Stillwater and Oak Park Heights, there's a you should have gotten this document in your mail that you need to fill out that tells you the rules. And see, if you read it, this is some of the highlights. See double bunked cells. So there you go. All right. And then, members, also, this Thursday we will not be meeting because we have session at 11, and so we'll just take that day off. So, Representative Lesh, you're first up. Representative, I'm sorry, House File 389. You want to move your bill? I understand it needs to go somewhere else. Representative
Lesh. Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd move House File 389, recommended that it pass and be re-referred somewhere else.
To the Commerce and Consumer Protection, Finance, and Policy Committee is the correct motion. Representative Lesh.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. I have testifiers. Mr. Chair, House File 389 addresses a long-simmering issue related to the collection of the fees by which we fund our emergency 911 service in the state of Minnesota. As members are aware, if you have a phone line, the carrier imposes a tax on your bill in order to fund the 911 fees. That has not worked very well in the case of prepaid phones that you can buy in a gas station or a supermarket. So what this does is this imposes a separate way for retailers to collect that. There's some dispute about it. Obviously, the retailers don't want to have to be put in the position of having to collect this separately. But members may or may not be aware that the legislation specifies that this is a tax to be paid by the consumer. So TracFone, which is the major carrier that this has affected, has just stopped paying what they believe were their accurate share of the 911 fee and said, make us. So what we're doing is we're imposing it at the consumer level. As I stated, there still are some ongoing discussions about how this impacts consumers and also retailers, and I believe the grocers are going to testify against it for that reason. With that, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'd like to introduce Ms. Rydell from Verizon.
Ms. Rydell, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Paymer and committee members. My name is Nancy Rydell. I'm the Director of State Tax Policy for Verizon, and I am here to testify in support of House File 389. It is a very important issue for the wireless industry, and as Representative Lesh commented, prepaid segment of the wireless market is what this bill is addressing. It's the fastest growing segment of the wireless industry, and it's growing about double the rate of postpaid consumers at this point. Postpaid is what most of us think of. We get a monthly bill, and all the taxes and fees are applied on our bill, and the end consumer is readily able to pay those taxes and fees that are imposed. In the prepaid segment of the market, it's not that easy because there is no bill. And because of the growing segment of the prepaid consumers, there's a lot of 911 fees that are not being collected and remitted. There are currently different ways that some of the 911 fees are being remitted on behalf of prepaid subscribers, but it's is not a consistent and reliable, predictable method of ensuring that all of the prepaid consumers are actually paying in their fair share of the 911 fees. So this solution has been in the works for probably 3 or 4 years. It was kind of an industry initiative that was agreed to by the public safety community, the retailers across the country. And as I said, it's been a multi-year effort to try and get this solution for the prepaid consumers. It has been endorsed by NCSL, I believe it was 2009, and since then it's been adopted in 26 states. And we're working in additional states to get the rest on board, if you will. So it is definitely a growing, a solution that's been recognized as appropriate for this segment of the market. Again, it would collect the fee at the retail point of sale, which is really the only opportunity to collect those fees from the end consumer, since there is no bill. And when you buy a prepaid card, you don't really have a financial connection with the carrier. In other words, I believe it's 70, probably closer to 80% of prepaid transactions are purchased through third-party retailers, such as, you know, Walmart's, Best Buy's, or other smaller retailers. So it is a huge sort of gap in the net, if you will, of ensuring that all of the consumers are paying their fair share. So I can stop and would be available for any questions.
Questions of Ms. Rydell. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make a point of clarification. This is not a new tax, correct? This is just collecting on an existing resource. This is nothing new. This is just trying to collect what you're not currently collecting, correct?
Ms. Rydell.
Chairman Famer, Representative, that's true. It's not a new tax. It's actually a fee that is existing now. It's just a method of ensuring that everyone is paying it on the same, same equitable grounds, and it's parity for the end consumers.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Do you have other witnesses, Representative?
Well, no. Other witnesses, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone that wants to speak in opposition to the bill? Can we have someone from the Department of Public Safety address the bill?
All right, Mr. Chair. I would note last time the grocers did testify against it for obvious reasons. Representative Neuberger, to them it feels like a new tax because they weren't having to collect this at the point of sale anymore. And now they would have to start doing that like they do for sales tax. But no, it's not intended to be a new tax at all.
My name is Jackie Mines. I'm the director of the Emergency Communication Networks Division, which is part of the Department of Public Safety, and it is our division that collects 911 fees. Go ahead.
Please.
Our organization has been working with the wireless industry over the past few years because we do realize that there are some retailers or prepaid providers that are not maybe submitting all of the fees, such as TracFone and maybe a few others. We do receive fees from wireless carriers on their prepaid, but they are making an assumption on that, and so it is in the interest of equity, this would be probably the most reasonable way to collect from the prepaid subscriber. And we do anticipate that with the changes happening in the market, that if we don't do this, we could probably see a decline in that revenue stream.
Ms. Mines, how long have the prepaid wireless customer companies not been paying the fee?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have worked out a number of different options, about three different types of options that a carrier can make some assumptions to collect the fee. So at this point, We don't get exact numbers from the carriers on what percentage of the fees that they submit are from prepaid, but we do know that we collect from, for example, Boost Wireless, which is a prepaid provider, and a few more in the state directly. What we don't know is if those carriers are collecting at 100% of their prepaid.
Well, how does I'm just trying to figure out how the department would know, you know, would gather all this information to make sure that carriers are paying what they were expected to pay, and whether if they owe the state any money for monies not collected in past years.
We do it based on percentages available through the CTIA, which is the Telephone Wireless Association industry, and basically we can probably make some assumptions based on the size of the network they put in, how many subscribers that they're supporting, and we can look at how many fees we collect. So we have a pretty good idea, but we don't know exactly. And part of this bill does require that carriers would submit that type of information to us, so we would be able to manage that.
So, Ms. Mines, in the fiscal note, then, is the $3 million biennial revenue, is that based on those assumptions, or is that based on going forward from here?
That would be based on some assumptions we've getting from the wireless industry.
From past years, or going forward from here?
Going forward from here.
So is there any money that is owed the state from past years, or is that not part of your assumptions?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Lash.
That is the subject of ongoing litigation between the Minnesota Department of Revenue and certain carriers. And I can tell you, in response to your previous question, TracFone, the big goose in this example, was I believe it was 2004 or 2005, where they stopped paying the estimated amount of revenue that they expected they owed, based upon the advice of their general counsel that this was to be paid by the consumer, not by the company. So they just stopped paying. So that's the subject of an ongoing dispute with the Department of Revenue. And the estimated part involves, well, I guess I'll just stop there rather than go into the details of it and screw it up, Mr. Chair. Because I would.
Okay. All right, then, other questions? Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm assuming that this additional revenue is going to all go into the 911 special reserve fund and won't be used in the general fund.
Ms. Mines.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is correct. The 911 special revenue fund supports the 911 program and the ARMOR statewide radio system.
Okay. Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One other question. So you said you had a pretty good idea in terms of the revenues. You mentioned, what, $3 million or thereabouts?
Mm-hmm.
So what is that going to buy us in the 911 reserve fund, that additional revenue? What will it be going for?
Ms. Mines.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we would want to put that towards expanding the functionality of the next generation 911 network so that we could provide text messaging for the deaf and hard of hearing through 911 network, and also to geographically code our 911 database so that when wireless callers give us calls and we can better locate them. And then there are other feature functionalities we're expecting in the future. But our next generation 911 efforts today are only funded to build out a high-speed network to the PSAPs. That doesn't include any additional feature functionality that we will need to provide.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions of Ms. Mines? Very good. Did I see some? Was there any opposition to this bill besides the Minnesota Grocers Association that have the letter? No. Representative Lesh, then, do you want to wrap it up?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Please vote yes.
Representative Lesch will is asking the committee to pass House File 389 and re-refer this bill to the Committee on Commerce and Consumer Protection, Finance, and Policy. Is there any discussion? All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye. 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 Opposed? That motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Lesch. Commissioner Lindsay, you should have, members, a packet from the Department of Human Rights. I'm not sure if we're getting a PowerPoint presentation in addition, or we are. Commissioner Lindsay, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Paymar, for that welcome, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you and to the members of the committee. I haven't had a chance to formally meet each of you, so I thought I would start by just giving you a little background about myself. My name is Kevin Lindsay. The last name is spelled L-I-N-D-S-E-Y, and I am the current commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. I graduated from law school in 1991. As a third-year law student, I had the honor of serving as the editor-in-chief of the Iowa Law Review. I began my professional career with the law firm of Oppenheimer, Wolf & Donnelly. In addition to the Oppenheimer law firm, I also have worked at the law firm of Howland, Lewis, Nyland & Johnson. I have in-house experience as an attorney and also as an individual leading human resources at the firm of Axis, Inc. Axis, Inc. is a company which is dedicated to providing health care services for individuals under the various Medicare waivers. Finally, I have public litigation experience, having worked at the Ramsey County Attorney's Office before coming to my current position. As an attorney, I've had the good fortune to successfully argue cases to a jury trial and have appeared before the Minnesota Court of Appeals and the Minnesota Supreme Court, and have also tried cases in federal court. I volunteered to serve locally on various boards, most notably the St. Paul Public Housing Authority, Walker West Music Academy, the Association for Residential Resources in Minnesota, which is the largest trade association providing care for individuals with developmental disabilities, and I've also served on the Board of Senior Resources. Today I'd like to provide a brief overview of the Minnesota Human Rights Act, provide you with an overview of the operations of the Department of Human Rights, and discussion of the governor's budget proposal. At any time during the presentation, I would welcome any questions that any members of the committee have. The Human Rights Act is codified in Minnesota Statute 363A. Specifically, Minnesota Statute 363A02 provides, it is the public policy of the state to secure persons in this state from discrimination in the following six subject matter areas: employment, housing, real property, public accommodations, public services, and education. The legislature within the statute went on to note that, quote, such discrimination threatens the rights and privileges of the inhabitants of this state and menaces the institutions and foundations of this democracy. The legislature went on to add that, quote, nothing in this chapter shall be interpreted as restricting the implementation of positive actions to combat discrimination, end quote. Again, this legislature spoke that it goes to the very cornerstone, the very foundations of our democracy, to make sure that individual citizens are free from discrimination. An individual can generally allege that he or she has been discriminated against on the basis of the following protected class statuses under the Minnesota Human Rights Act: race, color, creed, religion, national origin, sex, marital status, familial status, disability status, status with regard to public assistance, sexual orientation, and age. I qualified my prior sentence with the word generally because, depending on the subject matter area of the Discrimination Act, the Act provides certain exceptions to this general rule. For example, age is not protected class under housing discrimination. Additionally, marital status, familial status, public assistance, and age are not recognized protected class status in the area of public accommodation. There are several duties under the Minnesota Human Rights for which I am responsible for implementing. There are 19 which are identified early on within Subdivision 6, and then there's also a subdivision later on, 36-38-36, which outlines employment opportunities. But specifically, the Act provides and identifies three primary duties. The first is that I'm charged with the responsibility for issuing complaints and investigating charges of discrimination. Second, I am charged with the responsibility for ensuring that all vendors of the state provide equal employment opportunities. And then finally, I'm charged with the responsibility for using education, conference, conciliation, and persuasion to eliminate discrimination and disparate outcomes. I'd like to discuss in depth each of these primary three duties. I'd like to begin with the first duty, issuing complaints and investigating charges of discrimination. Let me begin by discussing this duty by addressing some of the most common misperceptions of the scope of the work of the department and its relationship with other administrative agencies. First, there is no one federal agency that has the same breadth of responsibility for investigating claims of discrimination as a department. Remember, the department is charged with investigating employment, housing, real property, public accommodation, public services, education, and discrimination claims. At the federal level, you would need to combine several administrative agencies to accomplish this task. For example, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission is responsible for investigating employment discrimination claims. The Housing and Urban Development Agency is responsible for investigating housing discrimination claims. The Department of Justice is responsible for investigating public accommodation and public service discrimination claims. The Office of Civil Rights within the Department of Education is responsible for investigating education discrimination claims. Additionally, the Minnesota Human Rights Act provides greater protection because the Act provides for greater personal jurisdiction over entities than federal law. For example, generally speaking, an employer is not subject to federal discrimination law until the employer reaches 15 employees. Under the Minnesota Human Rights Act, the employer is subject just by virtue of being an employer. Second, Minnesota prohibits discrimination against a broader number of protected classes than federal law. For example, Minnesota law prohibits discrimination against marital status, sexual orientation, and public assistance, whereas generally speaking, federal law does not offer such protection. In fairness, there are certain instances where federal law offers more protection than a Minnesota Human Rights Act. For example, federal law prohibits national origin discrimination, whereas the Minnesota Human Rights Act provides no such prohibition. Another common misperception about the department is that the investigation work of the department could be done by other human rights agencies in the state of Minnesota, or alternatively, the work of the department could be done by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Let me be clear, this notion is false. The Minnesota Department of Human Rights is the only administrative agency in Minnesota with the resources and, more importantly, the jurisdiction to process investigations filed with the department. To underscore this point, if the Minnesota Department of Human Rights did not exist, many Minnesota citizens would have no administrative recourse to have their claims of discrimination investigated. Moreover, more costs and burdens would be borne by the judicial branch of government by virtue of processing more claims of discrimination and responding to citizens' inquiries of discrimination. I know in speaking with Chair Paymar's assistants, there is a concern among some members of this committee that there is a duplication of effort between the Department of Human Rights and the human rights agencies in St. Paul and Minneapolis, as well as a duplication of effort between the department and the EEOC. Let me assure you that that is not the case. As an aside, there are approximately 35 local human rights organizations beyond the human rights agencies of the city of St. Paul and Minneapolis. None of those local human rights organizations, however, are charged with investigating charges of discrimination. The vast majority of these local human rights organizations have a budget of $500 or less. While the City of St. Paul and Minneapolis do have the ability to conduct investigations of discrimination, the geographic jurisdiction of those agencies is vastly different than the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. The Minnesota Department of Human Rights covers the entire state of Minnesota. Currently, the department has an active file of discrimination in 63 63 of the 87 counties in the state of Minnesota. We literally have charges from the very top of the state to the very bottom of the state. In comparison, obviously, the human rights agencies of the Minnesota Twin Cities Agency, City of St. Paul and Minneapolis, are limited to the city boundaries of those respective cities. Additionally, the Minnesota Department of Human Rights completed nearly three times as many investigations as was completed by both Minneapolis and St. Paul human rights departments. Again, as I discussed earlier, there's no one federal agency that is responsible for investigating claims of discrimination in the same subject matter area. And again, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission is limited only to employment cases. As stated earlier, the EEOC, its jurisdiction starts at 15 employees. So there are a variety of charges which could be brought against Minnesota employees that the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission would have no jurisdiction over in the state of Minnesota. Some of the members who've had the opportunity to sit on this committee and have oversight over the Department of Human Rights are aware that the majority of cases, majority of charges filed with the department are employment cases, and that is the case. Currently today, approximately 60% of all charges filed with the Minnesota Department of Human Rights are employment-related matters. The backlog of the EEOC probably needs to be mentioned at this point in time. When I was before this committee in April, I believe, of 2011, I had conducted some research as it relates to what the EEOC had conveyed to the United States Senate about its projected backlog. And at that point in time, the EEOC was projecting a backlog of nearly 100,000 cases by 2015. There has been progress made by the EEOC, but they have a substantial backlog and will continue to have a substantial backlog for the balance of this decade. The EEOC has reached out to fair employment practice agencies such as the Minnesota Department of Human Rights, the St. Paul Human Rights Department, and the Minneapolis Human Rights Department to ease its respective investigation backlog. Therefore, there is a work-share agreement between the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. Between October 1st of 2011 and September 30th, 2012, the department investigated more than 402 charges, which could have been cross-filed with the EEOC. The governor has said people who live and do business in Minnesota rightly expect government to work faster, better, and more efficiently. We who serve in government have an important obligation to improve how it works. We have taken the governor's words to heart with the department and believe that we have made significant progress. During the past biennium, the department has been committed to streamline its processes to increase efficiency in one, completing more investigation memorandum, and reducing the time to complete investigations. When I assumed the position of commissioner in March of 2011, the first, the most consistent, and the loudest concern that I had heard from individuals within the community is that the department was not investigating its cases, and that the department was taking way too long to complete its investigations. As someone who has practiced employment law for my entire career and having represented clients in matters before the department and the EEOC, I could attest that there was some merit to the concerns of the community. Accordingly, I set out to change the department's investigation process. Apologize for the typo in the presentation. It says the department issued 238 investigation memorandum in 2011. It should actually be 241. I won't keep you in suspense as it relates to whether we have changed the department's investigation process, because the answer is an unequivocal yes. In 2002, the year that we have just calendar year that we have just completed, the department issued 596 investigation memorandums. So the department has doubled its output in the number of investigation memorandums completed. During the last 6 months, the average age of probable cause determinations has dropped to 357 days, and the average age of a no probable cause determination had dropped to 293 days. I think the changes that have been implemented at the department will not only result in a short-term improvement, but will likely lead to long-term changes within the department. If we take a look at the slide, slide 10, and the graph in slide 10, we look at the performance in 2011 to 2012. Note that we did see a drop in the average length of time for cases. The most telling thing in 2011 is that there was only 10 investigators on average for that year. And then we also had the government shutdown, which negatively impacted the ability of the department to conduct investigations. The apples to me is 2010 to the present. 2010, on average, the department was taking 393 days to process investigations. In 2012, it had dropped to 311 days, or a drop of 82 days. And again, the number of investigations completed, again, there's almost a doubling from 257 in 2010 to 596 in 2012. How did we do it within the department? The first thing is that you ask your staff for their best ideas. The governor has asked all the commissioners for their best ideas, and I've returned the favor to my respective staff and asked for their very best ideas. One was the ability to have more laptops to conduct more in-field investigations and to receive more training. We also looked at streamlining the charge drafting process. The department used to use questionnaires to assist it in the processing of charges. We eliminated the use of questionnaires, and that probably dropped the time frame from the initial visit to the actual start of an investigation by 65 days. We conducted 10 training sessions during the first 12 months. We implemented a rocket docket, specifically within the statute, Minnesota Human Rights Act 363A28, Subdivision 6. It provides that the commissioner can identify and prioritize the following types of cases. Cases in which there is irreparable harm if immediate action is not taken. Evidence that the respondent has intentionally engaged in reprisal discrimination. A significant number of recent charges against the respondent. If the respondent is a governmental entity. Actions which may broadly promote the policies of this chapter. And charges which are supported by substantial and credible documentation, witnesses, and other evidence. This may not necessarily seem like a significant undertaking to identify and prioritize these cases, but unfortunately the culture at the department had become that when a new case came in and would have fit within one of these six categories, the department staff understood that they should take that case and take it to the back of the line. And I shared with staff that in private practice, if there was a dispute which could be quickly resolved by the attorney picking up the phone and calling the other side, that they would do so. They wouldn't put that case at the back of the line. So, for instance, there was a case about a month or two after becoming commissioner, which an individual who was sight impaired came into a restaurant, and the restaurant owner told the individual that they could not bring in their guide dog. Now, that is an ideal case of sort of a rocket docket type of a case, in which there is a clear violation of sort of the ability to use one's guide dog within a public restaurant. On the flip side, there are times in which we have charging parties which have a misunderstanding as it relates to what the law provides them as an employee, in which there is no basis upon which for them to proceed going forward. Those cases are also identified as rocket docket cases. During the last calendar year, we identified approximately 200 cases for rocket docket treatment. To give you a comparison, that's roughly about the number of charges which were investigated by the City of St. Paul and the City of Minneapolis last year. Finally, we reorganized operations. We combined our intake and enforcement unit into one large enforcement unit and then had the enforcement unit officers rotate the responsibility for taking intake charges. Slide 12 identifies sort of the closure trends, and again, you'll note that when we look at the trend of the number of closures, there's a dramatic increase in calendar year 2012 over the preceding 5 years. If you have questions as it relates to the number of closed PC and NPC determinations being slightly less than the number of investigations completed, there's two reasons for that. The first, a case is not closed until the party has exhausted their appeal rights. Second, a PC determination has not been fully settled or resolved until the department, a PC determination may not necessarily be fully settled or resolved in the calendar year in which the investigation has been completed. So again, to the extent that we have an investigation which resulted in a PC determination in November or December, we would engage in conciliatory efforts to resolve or settle that dispute. That may balance, that may come over into 2013. And within the last 2 weeks, we probably resolved three or four cases in that fashion. Equal employment opportunities should be provided to all citizens in the state of Minnesota. The department follows the mandate of the Minnesota Human Rights Act, in which we issue certificates of compliance. So an individual contractor seeking to do business with the state of Minnesota in an instance in which they're doing more than $100,000 worth of work has to first obtain a certificate of compliance. The current statute provides that we are to issue a certificate of compliance either in 15 days or to explain to a contractor the reasons for why we have not issued a certificate of compliance within 15 days. After a contractor obtains a certificate of compliance, they begin particular work on a project. We then ascertain whether they are utilizing good faith efforts to ensure equal employment opportunities are provided. This is to individuals who are identified as minorities, for women, and for people who are identified with disabilities. During the biennium, the department was able to process more than 90% of its certificates of compliance within 15 days. One of the proposed statutory changes which we are seeking to move forward with is to reduce the time frame for the department to be able to process all of the certificates of compliance within 15 days. As a practical matter, currently that is what is occurring, because again, the department has to issue within 15 days the reasons for why it's not going to issue. So for us, we felt that it was appropriate for all businesses for us to be able to convey that information within 15 days. In the last 60 days, the department has issued more than 98% of the certificate of compliance within 15 days. So we believe that we have looked at our processes and will be able to meet that initiative. The Act also provides specifically that the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Rights is to set construction goals. In doing so, we met with agencies, labor unions, contractors, and other interested stakeholders throughout the state of Minnesota for the purposes of identifying what the construction goal should be. Historically, the Commissioner of the Department of Human Rights has set the goals at the beginning of the decade, and they say, therefore, the balance of the decade. The data primarily used by the Commissioner is data from the U.S. Census Bureau. The U.S. Census Bureau typically publishes that data at the beginning of the decade, and we then vet the data after that. We adjusted the goals for the Twin Cities 7-county metropolitan area in April 2002. We anticipate adjusting the goals for the balance of the state in May of this year.
Commissioner, we have a question before you go on. Representative Kelly. Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Lindsay, just before we go too far past the amount of time that it takes from the time a case has started, I'm just curious, in that process, what are some of the delays? What are some of the things that take the longest as we go from 1 to 311 days? What are issues in there that just take the longest?
Commissioner Lindsay.
I can't really speak to the delays for the cases that have been in the inventory for prior to my becoming commissioner, but I can say that when a new case comes to the department, the challenge for the department in some instances in processing a case in less than 300 days are typically the following. Where the charging party has alleged several different claims, sometimes we might have a situation in which the charging party alleges four or five different claims, which entails potentially interviewing more than 10 or 11 witnesses. Sometimes it is a delay in getting back documentation from the respondent. The administrative rule provides that respondents are to provide documentation back to a request by the commissioner within 15 days. I would say on average that is probably 35 to 40 days. And there are some cases in which we have very small employers. We no longer have as many of them doing more than 100 days, but there were a substantial number of respondents had gone beyond 100 days prior to my becoming commissioner. That had increased the average completion rate for investigation.
And Mr. Chair and Commissioner Lindsay, just educate me a little bit. Now, the courts are not involved in this process at all. When you get a case and it's under your jurisdiction, you take it from the first time you hear it all the way to closure, right, and can assess penalties to the certain levels.
Commissioner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. We do assess it from the very beginning. That the part as it relates to assessing penalties, it's probably helpful to give a little clarity as it relates to what happened after a probable cause determination. So the investigator has completed investigation, made a determination that probable cause exists. The assistant commissioner typically calls the respondent's attorney and then seeks to conciliate or try and settle the respective matter at that time. I would say more than 90% of the time, the matter then gets resolved at that point in time. If it does not get resolved, in a few instances, the charging party might seek to retain an attorney and then proceed to litigate the matter. In some instances, we as a department forward the matter over to the Attorney General's office and then proceed to litigate on behalf of the state of Minnesota and the individual.
Representative Kelly.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the clarification.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Lindsay, I know that there was issues about getting the compliance decided and out, but in working with the African American community, there's been a lot of complaints over the years about the compliance not really being thoroughly investigated, as to contractors come in and say, I couldn't find anybody available, or they put on that they have so many hired and then they don't continue them on the job. That's just as big an issue to me as getting out the compliance notification to the contractor. What has been done about actually getting investigations out to make sure that those are actually real excuses and that they're not just, as in the past, made up?
Commissioner Lindsay.
Chair Paymer and representative members of the committee, I appreciate the question. I think it's a twofold response to you. There's a part as it relates to examining the good faith efforts, and then the second part is creating an environment for job opportunities to be provided to individuals who historically have not had them. So the first part, what are we doing in the efforts of good faith? We have been at the table with the Sports Facility Authority as it relates to helping them design what an equity plan would look like and what good faith efforts should look like. We have submitted a very detailed plan as relates to how to conduct good faith efforts on that project, with the idea that that would be a prototype for how the department would move forward in assessing good faith efforts on other projects. I do take your concern and your question as relates to how vigilant the department has been in the past as relates for ensuring good faith efforts. We have been very clear in communication and conversation with contractors that what we are looking for is not a quota as it relates to attainment of a particular number, but as it relates to how they are actually utilizing and implementing best practices in human resources going forward and being able to document that they have utilized efforts to maximize best practices. And I have shared with both sides of the equation on this, is that this is almost a strategic inflection point, I would submit, in the course of not only the region or the state, but I would say our country. And that is because of the changing demographics which are going on within our country. More than 10,000 individuals every day turn 65. In the state of Minnesota, 10 out of 11 individuals over the age of 55 identify themselves as white, not of Hispanic origin. More than 35% of the children currently in kindergarten through 12th grade identify as people of color. In the region known as the seven-county metro, more than 45% of those individuals will be people of color by 2040, and more than 50% of those individuals will be of working age adults by 2040. So whatever your recruiting efforts have been from a strategic inflection point as a business, you are probably going to have to change those respective practices. And we have tried to suggest that we can be an assistance to businesses and thinking differently on how they can go about recruiting. With that said, the Department of Labor has met with various unions, contractors, and we have identified ideas, strategies to benchmark different opportunities to meet the goal which has been set in the seven county metro area. There will be an event on March 7th in which we'll kind of formally roll that out, but that has been received very well, I think. And I think we are going to start making more progress moving forward in providing workforce and job opportunities for individuals who are interested in construction.
Representative Mullery. Okay. Please continue with your presentation, Commissioner.
The last bucket that I want to share with you is that education, conference, and conciliation. Specifically, we're going to start with education. In January of last year, I attended and presented at the first, what I understood to be the first Native American Education Summit with Native American community and the sitting Commissioner of Education. We had the State Director for Education from Montana in as well to talk about Native American education issues. About 4 months after that, we convened all of the state ethnic councils and the State Council on Disabilities to have a listening session concerning educational issues from their respective position. The event resulted in about a 50 to 60 page report of ideas and recommendations going forward. The Human Rights Act provides that the Commissioner of Human Rights can create a task force, again, to reduce discrimination and disparate outcomes. I partnered with Commissioner Casilius to create a task force to carry the work forward from the listening sessions. That task force has now met about four times, and the various representatives of the state ethnic councils and the State Council of Disability are moving forward with some of the recommendations stemming from the listening sessions. After the governor's summit in North Minneapolis in April of 2011, there was a discussion about trying to bring more science, technology, engineering, and math, sometimes known by the acronym of STEM, into the public discourse and more into public education and trying to get more businesses involved in bringing STEM education to schools. I attended the event in May of 2011 during the 2012 on that respective initiative, and have been involved in other events with both the Minneapolis and St. Paul school districts as it relates to broadening the base of STEM instruction. Commissioner Rothman of the Department of Commerce has launched an initiative as it relates to financial literacy, trying to bring more attention to financial literacy to all Minnesota citizens. Again, this is a partnership with the state ethnic councils that we have attempted to work with in providing more information concerning financial literacy. I've had the pleasure of sitting on the Governor's School Bullying Task Force for one of the members of this committee, and that task force resulted in a report being created and a recommendation to propose legislation. Finally, the department has also convened and participated in various meetings concerning the issue of collateral consequences in employment. This has included political stakeholders, members of the business community, and members of the various advocacy groups. I would submit that the issue of, very broadly speaking, collateral consequences is a very significant one, not only for this body, but for the whole legislature to think about going forward. The Department of Justice, in speaking with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission in April of this past year in 2012, identified that approximately 92 million Americans either have an arrest or a criminal conviction in their history. And again, this is the Department of Justice saying this. So the question then becomes, if we have 1 in 5 or 1 in 4 Americans that has either arrest or a criminal conviction, and we're limiting their abilities to work, or limiting their abilities to housing, or limiting their ability in education because of this history that they have, and juxtaposing that with 10,000 baby boomers turning 65 every day, where is that workforce going to come from going forward? And again, this is not necessarily to say that go and employ everyone, because there can be legitimate, very legitimate reasons for saying to some individuals who've committed certain crimes that they can't be gainfully employed in some areas. But are we really, really, really ready to say that 92 million Americans need to be written off and that they can't participate going forward? Let me turn to the budget request. The administration has requested 2 additional fundings for full-time equivalents. We would primarily assign these 2 full-time equivalents to work to ensure equal employment opportunities are provided under state contracts. We anticipate with the St. Croix Lift Bridge, the Viking Stadium, the addition of construction projects over the balance of the next 5 to 6 years, that there's going to be increasing need for resources for the department to have. This is where the agency has been from a full-time equivalent standpoint. In 2008, the department had 43 full-time equivalents. As of October of 2012, we were down to 32. So we've had a dramatic decrease in the number of full-time equivalents within our department. The high, going back to, well, actually, the department had more than in 1999, but I do think that that's relatively significant in 1999 to point out that at that point in time, the department had 60 full-time equivalents. In 1996, the Office of Legislative Auditor had come in and done a report on the department and had indicated at that point in time that the department did not have adequate enough resources to actually conduct audits in the area of equal employment. And that's when the department had 60 full-time equivalents. So we have obviously become much more efficient at what we do, but we are truly at a point in which to adequately conduct and fully do the work, we would need some additional full-time equivalents. The last one is just simply on the compliance. And again, from that 1995 report, 7 down to 4 full-time equivalents. So with that, let me also say that I have Deputy Itmar Santiago here, and then Georgina Wendell, who is the individual who helps me with the finances of the department, here to also supplement and answer any questions that the committee might have as relates to the operations or the finances of the department.
Mr. I have a couple of questions, and I'm trying to understand the charts, and maybe I can ask some of these questions at a later time. But I know that one of the concerns about the department in years gone by was the how to ascertain the satisfaction level of charging parties who are bringing allegations of discrimination against a party or a respondent. And I think at one point we actually asked the Department of Administration to construct a survey of
individuals who had used the Department of Human Rights, and I'm not sure what that was very helpful, but that the survey. But how are you really measuring success? You can look at faster closure rates and things like that, but that doesn't necessarily tell whether someone who's believes they've been legitimately wronged and discriminated against has gotten justice from the department.
Chair Premier, I appreciate the question. I do know, in looking at the Office of Legislative Audit report from 1996, that either this committee or the legislature asked the department to conduct a survey. The survey at that point in time was after the termination had been rendered, and I can tell you, as someone who has tried cases, if you win, that's a great time in which to ask your client how you did at jury trial, but if you lose, that's not a good time in which to ask. So if there is a survey to come forward, I would suggest that that survey be some point in time before the ultimate determination has been rendered to either the charging party or respondent. And I would submit that what you're really looking for is that, from a due process standpoint, that person has been heard, that the questions that they have as it relates to sort of what the law should, what their rights are under the law, have been adequately explained, and that they understand them, and that they felt that the person in providing the service to them was prompt and courteous. I would submit that that has been what we have been trying to instill in all of our enforcement officers from day one since I have been commissioner, is those three things. Is that everyone should feel that they have received prompt, courteous service from us. They should know and understand sort of why we have decided the case in which the way that we have, and that what they have said to us, we have actually taken into consideration. I think we have done a very good job in that, and what I would point to is the times in which I have gone and spoken to various groups as relates to both the plaintiff's bar and the defense bar. I've probably been to about 10 events, and spoken twice to the State Bar Association Employment Law Section on this very issue. And the feedback that I get back most often is that they appreciate how quickly the department now responds back. It does not seem as contentious. And we now know from your investigation memorandums why you have decided the cases in which you have decided them. And I would say on average we probably are now writing a page, maybe a page and a quarter more, because we're providing more of an explanation as relates to our decisions.
So if you decide not to take a case, what alternatives does the charging party have? They have to seek regress in the court, or can they appeal the staff members to decision-making on probable cause determination going forward?
Sure. So to the extent that someone comes and seeks to file a charge with us, we would explain why we felt that they did not have jurisdiction. And if they did not have jurisdiction, they could decide at that point in time. They could either go to state court or to federal court. My sense, though, is that what we have said to them in that situation is that they would be better off talking to an attorney, because if we have made the decision that there is no jurisdiction, they are likely to be told that same thing in state or federal court, and they're likely to have wasted their time filing a pro se complaint. We would rather than have them ask another quote-unquote doctor for a second opinion, because if maybe they hear it from an attorney that they have no merit in that case, they will then be satisfied. But I would say that that's probably very rare. Most people, when they come to us and then we explain that they don't have jurisdiction, they're satisfied with that explanation, and then they don't actually file that pro se complaint.
Questions? Mr. Buchman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your enforcement officers review state contracts over $100,000 at this point in time. How long has that $100,000 been in statute or whatever, and is it inflation adjusted?
Commissioner Lindsay.
Thank you, Chair Paymar, and members of the committee. I don't know. I've been trying actually to find out the specific year when it was adjusted from 50,000 to 100,000 in the Office of Legislative Audit Report from 1996. That is discussed as relates to one of the recommendations for minimizing the detrimental impact of the department not receiving funding in 1996. So my sense is that within a year or two after that report was issued, that the legislature made the determination to increase the number from 50,000 to 100,000, thereby reducing the jurisdiction of the department and then easing the workload of the department at that point in time.
Mr. Chair. Representative Ubel.
So somewhere around maybe 1998, 1999, you know, it's a sad thing, but $100,000 just doesn't go as far as it used to anymore. And I'm just wondering if it's not time to take a look at that that bar again, from the standpoint of sometimes these compliance contracts and things can be quite a burden for a small business to comply with, to do the paperwork and everything else. It also might eliminate some of your need for additional staff. And from a realistic standpoint, if you were to keep going the way you're going, that number today might be $150,000.
Commissioner Lindsay?
Chair Paymar and representative members of the committee, I would submit to you that when you look at the overall number of small businesses and the impact of actually obtaining the certificate of compliance, it's actually very minimal, the amount of time. Again, we process the certificate of compliance in less than 15 days. On average, the internal number for the majority of those is done in less than 10 days. So it is not a substantial undertaking to submit the documentation and have the review. The examination for businesses going forward, the analysis and the work which is being done by the department, I would submit probably is a benefit to those respective companies, because if we find something as relates to a barrier to them being able to hire a more diverse workforce, that doesn't necessarily mean that a penalty is ensued at that point in time. That just means that we inform them and then ask them to remove the respective barrier.
Mr. Chair, okay, I understand that, and I think it's admirable that you're turning that stuff around as fast as you are. But if we continue to have a $100,000 limit here and if it's been around since the late 90s and we don't adjust that, pretty soon you're going to end up with, you know, you have, what, four compliance officers now. You'll be before us for a lot more as time goes on, simply because the value of these construction contracts and other contracts is increasing. So I would submit that that should be taken into consideration sometime in the future, and take a look at that lowered limit as inflation. We don't have a lot of inflation today, but I think it's fair to say it's coming, and we're going to have to take a look at that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kelly had a question.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. Commissioner Lindsay, just a follow-up on the processing side of things. You said part of the delay was just getting back information. Have you imposed a rather rigid penalty for not getting information back to you within, say, that 15-day time period?
Commissioner Lindsay.
Thank you, Chair Paymar, representative members of the committee. We don't have a per se rigid rule as it relates to getting information back, but I did inform members of the State Bar and various members of the legal community that I was aware that administrative agencies can take a negative inference from delay in receiving information. And just simply communicating to that, I think, has resulted in more prompt responses back to us. That's the stick. The carrot, though, that I also said at the same time is this, is that if you believe that a request from us is too burdensome, or it asks for too much information, or it contains sensitive information, please feel free to pick up the phone, just as you would have done if I was in private practice, and then ask me to narrow the respective scope of the request. and to see if we can come to some type of compromise and agreement as relates to what is a more reasonable request. That, I think, both, it's an and, not an either or, I think has really worked to resolve and shorten the length of time from us getting documents back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner, do you want, we don't have a lot of time left, but I'm wondering, are you prepared now to go through the budget, the governor's budget recommendations relative to your department and the change items?
Yes, Chair Paymar. Would it be helpful, as advantage of time, do you want to ask respective questions as it relates to the change items?
Well, why don't you just go through them and explain them, and then also, I mean, looks like there's a 4% increase in your biennial budget, and then there's several change items.
Okay. What I understand is that there's a change item titled Ensure Good Faith Efforts of State Vendors Through Contract Compliance, which you all have. And in there, we did discuss this within the formal presentation about the request for two additional full-time equivalents to work in the area of contract compliance. The bulk of the work being done by the department, just to follow up on a question which was asked earlier, they don't really fall into that category of $100,000 or $150,000. There's only a handful, maybe, of those respective contracts. The balance are much larger than that. The projects which we've identified here, like the Viking Stadium, the St. Croix Lift Bridge, additional, the interchange in downtown Minneapolis, these are large, substantial construction contracts. Those are the type of projects going forward that we're looking at to have additional resources available to do equal employment. We've also discussed, because of the changing nature of the respective work, being able to provide opportunities for individuals with disabilities on these respective projects. Are there questions over that respective change item?
I don't have. Are you going to talk about this fee?
Yes. The second one would be modified certificate of compliance fee and renewal period. The Chair Paymar and members of this committee, what we are looking here to do is that every 2 years, a business would supply or would submit its certificate, a request for, to obtain a certificate of compliance to us. We would move this such that they would do so every 4 years. And then to make this budget neutral, that we would adjust then the fee from $75 to $150. So if you could imagine applying for a driver's license and then having that time period doubled, that in essence is sort of the certificate of compliance sort of aspect that we're talking about here, is that the work of the department in sort of reviewing the good faith efforts of a contractor, that's separate and dependent, that's on what is going on a particular contract, but the actual submission of the certificate, you would have a longer period of time before you'd have to go and ask for that certificate again.
Okay, very good. Any questions? So just back to the budget item thing. The compliance staffing, so you will have two additional FTEs there from 4 to 6 then?
Correct.
Okay, and then the FTEs for the entire, are the 32, are those investigators, or is that your, that can't be your whole staff, or is that your whole?
That's the entire staff of the Department of Human Rights.
That's the whole entire staff. And how many of those 32 are actually investigators?
It'd be easier to talk about it sort of from the management perspective. There is myself, there is the deputy, Edmar Santiago, there is Assistant Commissioner Torrance, who oversees enforcement. That's what I would consider sort of senior management within the organization. The other individuals are responsible for enforcement or providing what I would refer to as technical assistance as relates to complying with the Minnesota Human Rights Act. We have some individuals who are administrative staff who provide support to both of those endeavors. So, for example, we have an administrative assistant who coordinates all the back and forth with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. We have an assistant that coordinates and works with the mediation program and then works with the conciliation process with the assistant commissioner. So I would view them as part of the enforcement effort, but I would not view them as investigators.
Well, get that broken down a little bit more? I'm just trying to get, like, huh, you know, if I call you, the department, and say I have a discrimination claim, I'm assuming do you call them caseworkers or do you call them enforcement officers? Or
if you wanted to sit down with someone to draft your charge, there would be 12 individuals within that group.
And what do you call those?
Enforcement officers.
And I know this is putting you on the spot, but do you feel that's sufficient?
I think there is a concern within the community to try and drive down the length of time of investigations, and in order to sort of make the same type of improvement as relates to driving down the length of time and maintaining the number of investigations that we're completing, we probably at some point in time will have to have more investigators.
Okay, very good. Okay, questions? Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is different about you and the equal opportunity employment agencies or organizations?
Commissioner Lindsay.
Thank you, Chair Paymar. Thank you, Representative, members of the committee. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, when I refer to the EEOC, I'm referring to the federal agency. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission investigates claims of discrimination throughout the entirety of the United States. That includes the territories of the United States. They currently have on their docket around 90,000 charges to investigate. If you were to ask attorneys practicing before the EEOC, they would probably say they take a more invested interest in larger cases, more systemic discrimination type cases. So, for example, when we were talking about collateral consequences in employment, they initiated an action against one of the large employers here in town that summarily dismissed employment applications if you indicated that you had ever been arrested. That was an action involving 400 to 450 individual applicants. That probably would not be a case the Department of Human Rights or a similar situated state human rights department would undertake, but that is the type of case, though, the Equal Employment Opportunity would identify and would undertake.
Representative Kiefer.
Thank you. They would focus more on the bigger corporations, multinationals, bigger cases. Is that what you're saying? And then maybe you would focus more on smaller companies?
Chair Paymar and Representative and members of the committee.
Smaller companies?
Chair Paymar and Representative and members of the committee. I wouldn't characterize it in that way.
Okay.
I think, just so that we're clear, we have charges in which we're investigating against all size companies in the state of Minnesota. We would probably not undertake, however, what I would refer to as a class action lawsuit. That's not to say that there couldn't be instances in which we'd undertake a class action lawsuit, but we are not, with 32 employees or 33 full-time equivalents as it is now, really set up to undertake litigating a case involving 450 applicants against any one size employer. That's a significant undertaking.
Representative Kiefer.
Thanks. This is kind of a different, we'll switch tracks now. I'm just wondering, is there any time where your organization might be presenting a lawsuit against another organization that might be funded with tax dollars or is a another state agency that you're finding a claim. So we're having, like, the government suing the government.
Commissioner Lindsay.
Good there. Thank you, Chair Paymar, and representative and members of the committee. The act itself, when I read the portion of 363.28, provides that one of the priorities could be discrimination, which could be done by a governmental entity as a priority for the commissioner. So, yes, there can be situations in which the department could bring an action, or it could be investigating a charge of discrimination brought by a citizen against the governmental entity. And I would say that's a very important thing to have done, actually, because within a democracy, if you feel that the government is discriminating against you and taking away your rights, it's hard to imagine that you truly have a real representative democracy.
Representative Kiefer. Okay, any other questions? Well, Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question here. I just want to try to make sure I'm clear on this. Where are the jurisdictional lines between your agency and the EEOC? How does that work out as far as whose territory is whose? If kind of a follow-up type of scenario, or if someone goes through the EEOC and doesn't get the result they want, do they then go through your administration or vice versa? How does this shake down? How does that jurisdiction work out?
Commissioner Lindsay.
Chair Paymar, representative members of the committee. There is a doctrine which is called res judicata and collateral estoppel, which exists under the law. So to the extent that you seek redress on the same set of facts and that you've had a determination which is made, that then precludes you from going to the next courthouse and seeking redress. And I would say, as commissioner, I have probably upheld res judicata or collateral estoppel at least on 15 occasions that I'm aware of. And it may have also been addressed by my enforcement officers at some earlier level. So I don't really see that scenario sort of playing out. As it relates to the jurisdiction, who it might undertake a respective case, we are in conversation with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission to make sure that we don't both initiate an investigation in a particular dispute. For example, if there was an action against, we can say, a very large company in the state of Minnesota where they were had an employee who was alleging disability discrimination, that might be a case which the department might undertake and investigate, because it might have the resources to be able to do a one-person, two-claim charge on behalf of the EEOC, and the EEOC might not feel that its resources are best utilized in that fashion.
Representative Neuberger.
So I just want to be clear then. So then there is really no jurisdiction. The caseload is determined between the two bureaucratic entities, correct?
Commissioner Lindsay.
Chair Paymar and representative members of the committee, I'm not quite sure I understand your question as it relates to the jurisdiction of the respective.
You want to rephrase that, Representative Newman?
If there's an issue that comes up, since there, you said that there really is no jurisdictional boundaries between the two organizations, that there's you come to a mutual agreement between yourself and the EEOC, so there's no standard there. It's basically done between the two entities, and the party that's in question has to wait to decide which entity is going to handle their case, since there is no hard and fast jurisdiction. Is that correct?
Mr. Lindsay.
Chair Paymar, representative and members of the committee, maybe it would be helpful to examine how this practically would work out. So if I'm a plaintiff's attorney and I wish to file an administrative charge either with the EEOC or the Department of Human Rights, the very first question I have to ask myself is, how many employees are at that employer? So if that employer has 10 employees, I'm not going to be able to file that respective charge with the EEOC. Then I have to ask myself the question as to what is the protected class status that I'm seeking to allege discrimination, and that also may preclude you from utilizing the resources of the EEOC. So there's a very first cut that there actually is a process by which you would wean or sort of self-select where you could file your administrative charge. Assuming the scenario is that it's beyond 15 and it's the same protected class status, it's in the charging party has the choice of deciding where they decide to file. And I would submit to you that's no different than you having the choice now if you decide to utilize the court system. So to the extent that you wish to use federal district court, then you have to ensure that you can meet the jurisdictional requirement, and that either means that it's a federal question, a federal law is involved, and in the area of employment discrimination, the shorthand for attorneys is Title VII or 42 U.S.C. 2000, and that would allow you to get into federal court. The fact that you can get into federal court, though, you could decide you don't wish to be in federal court, and you could decide that you want to file your discrimination suit in Ramsey County District Court. Both courts are available to you and could assist you in having your matter heard, and that's your choice. And I would submit to you that's no different than the EEOC and the Minnesota Department of Human Rights as administrative agencies.
Very good. Any further questions? Commissioner, thank you very much for your testimony. And I already did. This meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.